It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, last year, Apple became the first American company to be valued at $1 trillion. But so far, 2019 hasn't been so nice to them. We'll talk to a tech columnist about why you holding on to your iPhone a couple years longer and other changes in the market may spell bad news for Apple.
First, tourism is one of the biggest industries in the world, and it's getting bigger. The UN World Tourism Organization says that in 2017, there were more than 1.3 billion tourist arrivals around the globe, and tourism is estimated to support about 1 in 11 jobs around the world.
But more travelers bring often more challenges for tourist destinations. Local culture, the environment, and livability for permanent residents all get put under threat when an area becomes too popular.
Cities in Europe and elsewhere have even seen local residents protest the arrival of tourists. Our next guest says that government intervention is the only way to create lasting solutions to the problem of runaway tourism.
Elizabeth Becker is a journalist and the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. She's a former senior foreign editor for NPR. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Well, you wrote that book a few years ago about the exploding business of travel and tourism. What have the trends been like since 2013 or so?
Well, it's been more explosive than I had predicted. The biggest change that's new is the newest ingredient is Airbnb. That took off very quickly, and it's caused havoc around the world. Here in Washington, D.C., I don't know if you have it in Wisconsin, but here in Washington, San Francisco, New York, Vancouver, British Columbia, Rome, Paris, Bangkok, you name it. There's concern that Airbnb has gone around all the zoning rules that normally helps you maintain a mix of housing units and has skewed everything towards the tourists. So now you have cities like Barcelona closing down illegal Airbnbs daily in order to try to preserve something resembling local, affordable housing. That's the biggest big change.
There is often an attitude, and you've written about this, that once a city or a country brings in tourists, great, that's happy news. Let's just let those tourist dollars roll in and stop thinking about it. Is that a pretty common attitude for national and local governments?
That's sort of old school. That's starting to change because of two things. First, the over-tourism, the saturation has made people say, I'm sorry, but who's benefiting from this? It's certainly not me and it's not my community. And two, the consolidation in the tourism industry, like every industry, is becoming so stunning that the profits clearly aren't even resembling local profits, so that there's a tendency in many places to say, we don't want more tourists yet. Will you stop trying to encourage more tourists because we have to figure out how we could take care of the ones we have?
Let's look into some of the particular harms that you and many local leaders and residents are worried about. First of all, there's a concern about environmental damage, whether you're talking about in a city or a place with beautiful natural resources, the beaches, the natural heritage sites, things like that. What kind of environmental concerns do we have over tourism?
Well, first, looking at how do people arrive. If it's a lot of inexpensive airplanes, you're going to have air pollution. If it's a lot of inexpensive cruise ships, you're going to have water as well as air pollution. Then, if you're talking about the outdoors, you often have a beautiful scenic area where resorts are developed without understanding how you're going to wreck the environment. And then you don't have a sense of how many people can actually be accepted without turning the environment upside down. So you have places that advertise as ecotourism, but in fact they have completely distorted it. The good examples are countries like Costa Rica, which pioneered ecotourism and tries to be as careful as possible about maintaining the wildlife and still and the fauna and the flora while still making room for sensitive, responsible tourism.
Talking to Elizabeth Becker about the hazards of over-tourism in the United States and around the world. Another concern, Elizabeth, and you've already touched on this a little, is the idea that permanent residents are driven out of neighborhoods either because they're replaced by tourist resorts or they just can't afford to live in places anymore. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, this is a big problem in the United States, and the tourist cities that have responded to this are Charleston, South Carolina, where they said we have to protect the historic city for the locals, and they have passed a pretty strong controlling of Airbnb, the daily rental companies that do very short-term rentals and thereby take out the not only the housing stock, but raise the rents. So if you keep that at a level that your community thinks is affordable, then you're going to keep the residents in. But if you don't, you end up like New Orleans, where the city had lots of demonstrations about the creeping Airbnb that were pushing people out of the French Quarter and a lot of the historic districts and turning it into an area where you couldn't afford to live anymore, and it was crowded with bars and t-shirt souvenir shops. So that is a big problem, and once it tips, it's very hard to reverse.
A case you've been making both in that book and since, and you're starting to see this happen now, is that these problems and the other risks of over-tourism, they're not going to be solved without government regulation, whether that's the city or at the national level. What kind of things are you seeing communities around the world do to try to get this under control?
What is so wonderful about travel and tourism is also what's so difficult about it, because we all want to go to a different place and experience a wonderful different environment and get to know different people and different cultures. But that's a sort of saturation. A visit touches on every part of a life. So a city will have to decide how can they keep the tourists down in a very total way. So that's zoning rules. That's keeping the number of tour buses down, keeping them out of certain parts of the city or the country. I've seen towns that refuse to enlarge their highways so that those tour buses can't go into their towns. There's cities that are, and small towns too, but tourist areas that will now start to put things on the historical registry to protect it. Fishing villages that don't want to become entirely tourists will protect their piers, protect the fishing areas. And so it's a combination of industrial regulation through zoning, controlling the ways in which people can come to visit, and also how long they can stay, again, the number of hotels, so on and so forth. And then there are some new smart use of technology to figure out carrying capacity. So how many people actually come to your city? Where do they go? Should we have new cultural venues for them here, there, everywhere? And how do we come up with that number where we find that golden mean where you are not going to have too many, but you're going to have enough to in fact, enrich the economy?
One concern people might have is that, okay, if you throttle down the number of people who can come into tourist area X, there are fewer opportunities. Maybe that drives up costs, and we go back to a situation where only the elite, only wealthier people have the opportunity to gain the benefits of travel. Is that something you worry about?
Not really. I went into this thinking exactly that. But in fact, that's not the case. The areas that keep a high quality standard do not lack for visitors, and what is really luxurious is so beyond any of our means that it's not a consideration. I mean, you have no idea how wealthy these people are and what they have. So, like for instance, Bhutan is often brought up because they require a minimum of $250 spent per day in visiting Bhutan. And you say, oh my God, who can afford that? Well, in fact, people can, and they have backpackers come. And they said to themselves as they developed this is an industry. We want it to nurture and protect our environment and our society and our culture. And we want people to see the real Bhutan, so we're not going to make it into a Disneyland, you know, free-for-all. It's worked. They have problems. Everybody's got problems. But they have maintained that, and it's worked to everybody's benefit. And I thought 250 was a lot. But then you look at it and look at the way other people spend money, and it's not a lot. So up front, it's really hard to detour people. And if you are serious about visiting an area, you can find a way to do it.
We're talking to Elizabeth Becker. She's a journalist and author of the book Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the negative effects of overtourism in a place that you visited? When you travel, do you seek out the most famous destinations, or do you avoid crowded touristy places? If you live in a popular tourist spot like Wisconsin Dells or Door County, what's your experience been like? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we're picking up our talk with journalist and author Elizabeth Becker about the problem of overtourism and what can be done when a place gets too popular with travelers.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you traveled somewhere and seen the impact that maybe too much tourism has had? How do you seek out destinations that aren't touristy and overcrowded? Or if you live or have lived in an area that gets a lot of travelers coming in, do you think it's been a good thing overall? What do you think about the way your community dealt with the influx of tourists? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Tony is with us in Madison. Tony, hi. What have you seen?
Well, so I've traveled with my family. I have three kids, and we backpack quite a bit. So I've traveled around the country and gone as far as the Himalayas. And I see the effects of over-tourism. And I see the effects it has on sanitation and stuff in third world countries. And to me, that's the biggest question. But on the side with money, it's because I'm a working class guy. For us to go out of country, it has to be something in the neighborhood of $8 to $10 per person per day, not the $250 in Bhutan or any of those locales. Those are really just the high-end people, the high-end backpackers that can manage those.
Tony, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. His first point, Elizabeth, about sanitation facilities being able to handle that influx of tourists. I could see two options. The local place builds up their infrastructure to accommodate all the travelers coming in, or they do what you were talking about earlier and dial back the number of travelers coming in so they don't put a strain on their local facilities.
Well, in fact, the answer is all of the above. One of the reasons why Bhutan has charged this much money, and I'm wondering if Tony went to Nepal, where he saw the garbage and the sanitation, because Nepal has not charged the money, and it has resulted in a lack of infrastructure and garbage and things. So I think there can be an in-between, and in a developing country like Bhutan or Nepal, you're going to have a different response than in a country that already has the infrastructure. So I'm very sympathetic to a country that wants the tourists to help them develop the good sanitation, the good roadways, and so on and so forth. But I also understand that there are alternatives, and I'm glad that Tony and his family are finding them, and they are in both Asia and in Europe and in Africa and South America.
Happy travels, Tony. We'll go next to Matthew in Blue Mounds. Matthew, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What have you seen, Matthew, when you've been out touring?
Well, last year I took my family to Cuba when it was available to go on a non-charter group, and we had we went to Havana, and Havana was a great. It was a large enough city that it could accommodate the amount of tourists coming in. But then we went to Trinidad, which was the sugar capital, and it was a smaller community, and it was just overwhelmed by the tour buses, and it was not much of a pleasurable experience due to the fact that you walk down the main street, and it was just inundated with a lot of Americans, a lot of Europeans, and we find that it was not an enjoyable experience. And we were trying to find unique places and get off the beaten track. And every place we went, there was just more people than was acceptable for us. And the community was looking for those tourist dollars, but they were in a catch-22 scenario.
Matthew, thanks a lot for the call. And there's the irony, Elizabeth, over-tourism makes tourism less fun.
No, and you and the caller captured it beautifully, because I can see the crowds and I can see the confusion and no one is happy. And I doubt that the community made much money from it. The tour guides and the tour bus made some money, but I doubt that there was many coffee shops that made money. And the only thing I can suggest for the tourist, this is separate from the community, is that I'm afraid nowadays you're going to have to do a lot more homework. And if you have a good agent that you could, a travel agent, I've become a big fan of good travel agents, because they can steer you to a good place and a good way to make those trips and avoid those overcrowded places. And for the communities, they have to start saying, I'm sorry, we can't have this number of tour buses. We can't do it. We have to say on our own that we're going to have this kind of a community with this kind of options. And unfortunately, most of those decisions are not made locally. So I'm sure the tour buses into Trinidad, those were sent from Havana.
Talking to Elizabeth Becker, author and journalist, talking about the problems of over-tourism and what communities and tourists can do to try to get them under control. We'll go back to your calls now. Marcus is on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Okay, so I guess I heard the last caller say a catch-22. I guess I have another question that might be a catch-22. If you start building up the infrastructure of locales around the world and start trying to modernize it, don't you run the risk of that you actually take and change the very fundamental nature of where you're going to be going? And so it's going to stop feeling like you're going to a foreign country or a foreign destination, and it'll start feeling more like you're walking in a metropolitan area in the States or in a national park.
That is overall an issue everywhere, but I don't think the infrastructure itself is what's going to homogenize things. Homogeneity in tourism is a huge problem, and it's called Disneyfication, where you can't tell which city you're at because it's the same standard issue hotel or motel. It's the same standard issue cafe, different name. Infrastructure, I don't think, is going to be the issue. And protecting the culture and the foreignness of a place is at the root of the problem of over-tourism. Pretty soon, you're essentially selling, if you don't watch it, you're turning yourself and your community into a commodity, so that you're wearing your native dress in order to have your picture taken with a tourist, and then you charge them $25. Or you have your national dance that you dumb down so that a tourist can watch it for 10 minutes and not get bored. The list goes on and on. So that's a very serious issue that you put your finger on.
Thanks a lot for the call. Marcus, Sabrina joins us now from Baraboo. What do you see, Sabrina?
Hi. You guys are talking about this. I live in the Baraboo Dells area. I don't see a lot of this going on in the Dells, but definitely the natural areas in Baraboo, like Dewards Glen, some of the state-protected areas. I see a lot of overuse, especially by people who really don't appreciate the area or respect it, leaving trash, going off trails, and leaving it kind of trashed.
Thanks for the call, Sabrina. How can the managers of a natural area like that and, of course, the users of a natural area take better care, Elizabeth?
I think you sort of look at it as if it's your house and you're having a dinner party and you're inviting 12 people and 12,000 show up and that can't go on. So your natural area, you get serious. You demand respect by saying we can only have X number of people. They have to follow these rules. These rules are posted everywhere. There are fines. It's a normal, regular behavior. Respect us. Make sure that you don't trash. And if you're caught, you're in trouble. I think it's just that basic.
Thanks a lot for the call. Time for another caller. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. What's your experience been, Louise?
My husband and I went to Iceland last summer, and we experienced, because of their economic problems, they're trying to kind of make a comeback on tourism. So we were kind of trying to get a lot of the natural beauty, you know, the splendor which Iceland has, stunning. But we were always fighting with the tour buses, and because of it's an island, volcanic island, there's like one main road on the outskirt of the island, so everyone ends up on the same road, and we were just kind of uninformed and surprised by that. And we ended up staying at a bed and breakfast that advertised itself as a hotel, but it was really just somebody's house, and they had taken out extra bedrooms, and it turned out to be a really good experience, but we were kind of baffled when we arrived at this place, too. And again, I think someone's just trying to take advantage of the tourism dollars.
Sure.
But,
Louise, thanks a lot for the call. Elizabeth, I'm jumping in. You've written about Iceland some in particular.
Well, it's it overdid it. They have bottlenecks that they shouldn't have. And I would stay away, as a tourist, as a visitor, I would stay away from places like Iceland until they figured out how to control it. And again, everyone has to do much more homework. It's so easy to travel now. The prices are relatively low. Since globalization, we've all been able to go pretty much where we want to if we watch our pennies. But it's almost too easy, so we should be harder on ourselves, make more demands before we go, and don't expect things to work perfectly, but do your homework so you avoid the Icelands.
In our last few moments, Elizabeth, are you seeing a positive trend from tourists and from tourist areas?
Oh, yes. When my book first came out, people weren't quite sure what in the world I was talking about. And now tourist areas are not afraid to challenge assumptions. They demand to know who's benefiting from all this crowding. They are starting to say, well, listen, if this is a regular industry, we should ask of it what we would ask if oil drilling wanted to come in. People want to know how tourism is going to help them, and there are really new models of how to do it around the world, different cities, different nature areas. So there's a lot of positive to all of this.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Elizabeth Becker is a journalist and the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. She joins to talk about how many popular destinations are dealing with the issue of just too many travelers.
Investors in Apple got some bad news last week. The company had to make an unexpected announcement that they'd have at least $5 billion less revenue than they expected, making it the first time the company had to issue a warning like that in nearly two decades.
That was news the stock market didn't take so well, adding to some big losses in the company's value. Apple itself pointed to a number of factors that contributed. Now, market watchers are wondering if Apple can adapt as the device market changes.
Dan Gallagher is a technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street column. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dan, what prompted this warning from Apple about its revenue numbers last week?
Well, you know, typically publicly traded companies have to keep investors informed of, you know, what's called the material events, material changes. So if a company gives a forecast that, you know, revenue is going to be this much in a period, and then something changes before the next report that means that number would be materially different, they need to tell investors. So in this case, Apple, which always gives a forecast when it reports results, it forecasts the next quarter. In just 2 months' time, things seemed to change enough for the company to have to change that forecast, essentially lower it. And this was interesting because it's not uncommon for companies to do this. However, Apple has not had to really do this since 2002.
Wasn't it not too long ago that Apple was the first American company to be valued at $1 trillion? What in the world has happened since?
Well, yeah, they hit that. I mean, part of that was just that stocks have been on a tear. You know, there's been a what's called the bull market for, you know, the last 6-7 years. Stocks have continuously gone up, and that's been good for, you know, a lot of stocks across the board. And then Apple's just had, you know, Apple really, it's a highly profitable company. It's got, you know, it's got products that it sells at fantastic profit margins relative to what its competitors can sell for. So it's always been a strong business. And then, you know, coming into the, I think there was a lot of excitement around the, you know, the iPhone cycle that, you know, the new iPhones that came out last fall, there was excitement around that that was driving the stock up and other things. So, but between that, you had the stock running up to quite a degree to give it that kind of valuation.
Speaking of iPhones, certainly the sales of the iPhone has declined. What are some of the reasons for that?
A few things. I mean, one, these phones have gotten a lot more expensive. I mean, some of the newest phones are selling now start at prices that are like $1,000. And just to, you know, to pay outright. And, you know, that's a big change from, you know, when they were around the $600 and $700 range, and then go back even further when carriers used to subsidize your price and you just paid $200 out of your pocket. So, you know, the prices consumers pay have gone up, and the devices have actually gotten better. They last longer. The batteries don't wear out as much. So essentially, people are holding on to their phones for longer periods rather than, you know, the kind of 1.5 to 2 years that you used to replace a phone by. And then when you add to that the fact that, you know, economies in places like China are slowing, and a few other factors like that, you just have kind of essentially, you know, you don't have as much reason for a lot of consumers to just buy the latest and greatest device because, you know, I'm using an iPhone 7 personally. It's a very strong phone. And I personally didn't look at the phones that have come out even 2 years newer and see something that was like, okay, I gotta spend to have that. They weren't good enough, better.
Yeah, and that was the one thing I was going to ask you, because I have a, for instance, I have an iPhone 8 Plus, and there's really not a whole lot of difference between the iPhone 7 and, you know, the iPhone 8 Plus, or even the X, well, the 10, I always call it the X, but the 10. and there's some differences there, but there's not as much difference for people to run out and buy a new phone when they have one that works perfectly fine. Is that what you're seeing a lot of?
Yeah, especially since, you know, I mean, now the iPhone's a 10-year-old product line.
Right.
And I don't know how long you've been using it. My first iPhone was the 3G. It was the second phone they made.
I started at 5.
Yeah. Well, 3G was a good phone for the time. I mean, it was in advance. It was ahead of what other companies were doing like that. But after 18 months, my 3G was really, really ready to die. And the difference between that and the 4 that came out, just, you know, that was kind of the new phone at that time, was amazingly big. Like you got a really big step up in performance and speed and everything else. And you just don't see that now year by year. If you have a phone that, if, like I said, I have the iPhone 7, that's a 2-year-old phone. And I've played with the new devices that friends and that use, and they're nice, they're not worse by any degree, but they're not so much better that I think, oh wow, this is really worth all the extra money and that I would have to spend on it.
Dan Gallagher is a technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street column, and we're talking about some of the problems and issues with Apple. What does it mean, Dan, when people say that the device market overall is maturing?
Well, for Apple especially, Apple doesn't really sell phones into what we call the low end of the market. I mean, and we don't see that so much, I think, here in the U.S., but there's markets all around the world, like in India, where, you know, phones are just a lot cheaper because they have to be. And those are markets Apple doesn't really play in because they've always been kind of a premium company. They want to keep their profits strong. So in the market that they play in with phones, the higher end of the smartphone market, there's just not really any growth there. I mean, it's pretty saturated. Most of the people who are going to have phones have them. So for Apple now, its iPhone business, which is 2/3 of its revenue, is really annual replacement business. You know, every year they put out new phones, and their prospects depend on, okay, what percentage of their customer base is going to upgrade their phones. Because we're at the point now where we just don't have the share between Apple's iOS system and Android, which is, you know, the competing platform. Those haven't really changed in the last 2-3 years. So people who've chosen a platform are sticking with it for the most part. And there's not a lot of switching back and forth. So for Apple, that means you have to every year try to upsell some portion of your customer base to a new device.
Now, Apple has talked about, instead of continuing to go that route where you're trying to upsell, pivoting to focus on services. So what would that look like?
Well, they're doing that now. I mean, it's services is actually their second largest business segment if you look at their financials.
Okay.
And what that is, it's a hodgepodge of a lot of things. You know, it's the, you know, historically, like the music you bought to put on your iPod way back. That's, you know, that's now part of in services, and then movies, and then apps from the App Store, and then all things, kinds of things like the Apple Care warranty plan, and money they get from licensing, like Google pays them a certain amount of money every year to be the default search engine on the iPhone. So you have, there's a lot of things in that bucket. And so combined, it's been a nice growing, it's been growing much faster than the iPhone lately. And it's kind of their best, it's kind of their biggest bet on growing the company. The problem is that the iPhone business is so enormous. If you took it out totally from every other business, it would still rank, I think, among the maybe 15 or 20 largest companies in the world by revenue. It's 2/3 of their business. So you don't, mathematically, it's kind of hard to get to the point where services is kind of the main driver of the business. And then the problem is services are really tied to the company's hardware. You don't buy Apple Music if you don't have a device to play it on, for instance.
Right.
So you have a thing where, you know, for the business, yeah, it's a good different revenue stream for them, but it's still closely tied to the devices that they sell.
Now, I know Apple's having their issues, but wasn't some of this, though, inevitable in terms of their decline just by virtue of how profitable they are?
Well, profitable, yeah. They're a very large company. And like you said, you know, you get to a point where a company that's, you know, selling, that's doing more than $200 billion a year in revenue, you know, it's harder to grow that in a significant way. Like, to grow that by 20-30% is very difficult, especially when you're in markets that are, you know, sort of mature like they're in. So yeah, in a way, it was inevitable that their business would mature. And the challenging thing, if you go back years to where Apple was just selling computers and then they came up with this new product called the iPod, the iPod really put them into a new market that had a lot more interesting and bigger growth potential than just computers did. So that really helped kind of put the company on a new path. But now that they're the size that they're at, and because there's not a lot of markets really out there that are like the phone market, it's really hard to envision what new product the company could come out with that would really give it the kind of juice that the iPhone gave them years ago.
And finally, Dan, what kind of things, if it isn't a revolutionary product, and it seemed like Apple was coming out with something revolutionary, or they were taking something that had already existed and making it revolutionary, it seemed every single year, what kind of things are you watching for as Apple tries to change and adapt?
Well, I mean, they have to act like they're a big, mature company. And so I think you have to keep expectations realistic that they can find ways to, you know, still grow the business, you know, because in business, if you're not growing, you're, you know, eventually declining. They have to find ways to grow the business and have realistic expectations about that. And I think sometimes they're not credited for, you know, when they come out, they have come out with some interesting new products over the last few years. The AirPods, the wireless earbuds are a really good product. Apple Watch has gotten a lot of traction. It's not that they haven't had success stories. Again, it goes back to the problem of comparisons. The iPhone is such an enormous business that it's really hard to come up with something new that's going to have the same level of impact. I think that's why people were excited on the possibility that they might make a car, because conceivably that would be something that could be huge again and change. But that's a very difficult, you know, business, very different from what they've done. Margins aren't the same, and we don't even get the sense that they're really building their own car anymore based on some reporting. I mean, you know, maybe in some years that might happen, but it's really, I mean, Apple's just a big, mature company, and I think people have to really get used to that idea.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Dan Gallagher is a tech columnist for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street column. He was with us to talk about what's behind a bad last few months for Apple and how the company's dealing with changes in the market for devices.
Several groups filed suit today in a Dane County Circuit Court saying that last month's lame duck session and the laws passed as part of it are unlawful.
At the heart of this specific lawsuit's argument is whether a procedural step used by GOP leaders to call the session in the first place met the requirements of the state constitution. Here's Madison attorney Jeffrey Mandel, who is representing the plaintiffs.
The case is about the text of the Constitution and holding our government officials accountable for adhering to the Constitution.
Sean Johnson is WPR News' State Capitol Bureau Chief. He also co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Okay, tell us about this lawsuit saying, hey, this whole thing shouldn't have happened in the first place.
That's it. I mean, it's saying that the entire extraordinary session that we covered last month and everything that happened there was unlawful, that because the Wisconsin Constitution lays out two times when the legislature can meet, at such times as provided by law or in a special session. And a special session would be when the governor calls them back into session when they're not supposed to be there. So they would normally be adjourned at that time of year. If the governor called them into a special session, this lawsuit is basically saying everything they would have done would have been fine. But because they went into an extraordinary session where they're called back by legislative leaders, that's not something called for in the Constitution. So essentially call the whole thing off.
Extraordinary sessions have happened in the past, though, and they were created by, and if I'm reading this brief right, they were created by a joint resolution of the legislature in the past, not by a bill that passed the legislature.
Right. So
it's getting technical here.
Yeah. I mean, so a special session is something that is spelled out in the Constitution, but an extraordinary session is spelled out in a legislative rule. That is the foundation of why these things happen. And you're right. They have happened. Going back to 1980 is the first time that Wisconsin had an extraordinary session. It's had about the state's had about 24, I believe, 25 since, and these have been called by, you know, legislative leaders from both parties. So they haven't been totally out of the ordinary, but they have not gone back as far as special sessions, where if you look at the list, it goes on, you know, back a century plus. And so this case is essentially arguing that, you know, despite sort of this presumption that extraordinary sessions are things that happen in Wisconsin and that they have happened since 1980, there's nowhere in the Constitution that they're called for. So the extraordinary session that just happened, the lame duck session that just happened, the restrictions on Governor Evers' powers, the restrictions on early voting, that all goes
appointments,
away.
Appointments, everything.
Right. It was all unlawful.
Who's bringing this suit?
A few groups are bringing this suit. The League of Women Voters of Wisconsin is one of them. Disability Rights Wisconsin is another. Also, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities is another one of the groups. And so they're bringing the suit. And, you know, a lot of the case goes to speaks to ways in which they feel their groups have been harmed, you know, so like League of Women Voters does not like the restrictions on early voting. And so they're saying essentially that they have standing because of that, but they're not making the case about that, you know, so they're not bringing the case and saying, because these restrictions on early voting are bad, we think they should be overturned. It is strictly a procedural lawsuit.
Let's give a listen to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican, not a fan of the suit. Here he is.
There is absolutely, positively, no doubt that what the legislature did is constitutional because we have the right to convene ourselves in extraordinary session.
All right, this hits the state court system, not federal court. Ultimately, this could end up, depending on lower court rulings, in the state Supreme Court, right?
That is, I mean, if it advances past circuit court, yes. And so, I mean, you did see a pattern with a lot of Walker administration laws, especially early in his administration, where the legislature would pass them, he'd sign them, they would go to Dean County Circuit Court. A number of them would be put on hold by judges there. And ultimately, when they would get to the state Supreme Court, where conservatives had a majority, they currently have a 4-3 majority, the Supreme Court would uphold the laws. And I think if you're looking for a theme in the way that the state Supreme Court, this state Supreme Court has handled these cases, is that they have given the legislature leeway when it comes to procedural issues. I mean, think back to there was a challenge against Act 10 back in 2011 that said that it was unlawful because the legislature violated the open meetings law when they passed it. The court said that basically the lower court had infringed upon the legislature's powers there and, you know, wiped that clean.
Talking to reporter and Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about legal challenges to the lame duck session and the laws passed last month. And yes, I said plural. We've been talking about one of them, Sean, for people keeping score at home. What are some of the other lawsuits going on related to that session?
There's a few ways that this is being challenged now. So you've got this one that was filed today. This is the clean, basic challenge to the procedure in which
they
were passed.
It never happened.
Right. All of these things are gone. There is another complaint that was going to be filed, I believe, today by State Representative Jimmy Anderson. Representative Anderson is paralyzed from the chest down. He's in a wheelchair. And he said that because legislative leaders would never tell him when the vote was going to happen, he was unable to stay in the legislature overnight. He had to go home. He ended up missing the vote, which happened, you know, in the wee hours of the morning on December 5th for a session that had convened in the morning of December 4th. And so that's another open, open meetings law challenge. There's a federal case that challenges the restrictions on early voting. This is a revival of an earlier federal case that said that the similar restrictions on early voting were unconstitutional. And then this one's a little bit tougher to pin down, but we know that Governor Evers has said that he is going to find a way to change the stance of the state's lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Remember, this is one of his big campaign promises. He and Attorney General Josh Call, we're going to get Wisconsin out of this multi-state lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act. The lame duck session prevented them from doing that.
It says the Joint Finance Committee of the legislature, controlled by Republicans now, has to sign off on that.
Right, which, so it's not completely impossible that he could get out of that lawsuit, but he would need Republicans to go along with him. They're not going
to
do that. So all we know is that he said that he's going to send a letter to Attorney General Call to change the stance of the state's lawsuit.
All right, crazy thought. I'm not withdrawing from the lawsuit. I'm keeping the state in it. We're just on the other side now.
It could be interesting. I'm a little afraid to speculate.
We are not lawyers.
Because I don't know.
Right.
I mean, also Wisconsin is one of the lead plaintiffs in that case too.
Right.
So I don't know if that has something to do with it. But you could get into some interesting procedural what ifs there, including who would defend the state in this lawsuit that was just brought today,
right?
Because they're challenging Republican authored laws, a Republican lame duck session, but the case was brought against Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who has been critical of these lame duck laws.
They're saying, yeah, you can't, governor, enforce these unconstitutionally passed laws
in your official capacity. Now, who would normally defend the governor?
The Attorney General,
who also opposed these lame duck session bills and has talked about them as an abuse of power.
Now, the Republican Assembly, real quick, the legislature said, hey, we have a right to hire our own legal counsel in more cases than we had previously. They could do that in this case, but under this constitutional challenge, that never happened. So they could challenge their right to representation?
You can kind of like talk yourself into loops on this.
I just did.
That they have more power to hire their own lawyers because of lame duck, laws, which this lawsuit contends should be null and void.
All right, Sean and I will be back to talk about this more after we achieve our law degree.
Right.
We'll be back to talk about this in a few years so we understand it more fully. Sean, thanks a lot. Always good to talk to you. We'll be back on this again and again, I'm sure.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR News State Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us for a look at legal challenges to laws passed in last month's lame duck session of the legislature. As we heard, a constitutional challenge to the whole session, as well as smaller bits and pieces along the way. Keep following these stories at WPR.org. Go to the news page there. Time flies in pop culture. Today is the 20th anniversary of the release of the HBO show that changed TV to this day, The Sopranos. Now, I watched up to a point. Jarrell, you watched the whole thing, right?
I watched all of it.
Uh-huh. And you were a fan?
I was a fan of the show. I was a fan of all things HBO at that time,
uh-huh,
because it seemed like they just couldn't stop churning out hit shows and shows that were compelling. And Sopranos was one of them. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
That was the one. I mean, people point to that as one that changed the way TV is written and presented, everything. A game changer.
Yeah, it was. It was. It did change television. And I think that you're seeing now so many shows that are kind of patterned, at least the style patterned right after The Sopranos. It was just a tremendous show with tremendous performances.
Now, I throw an asterisk on there. I watched it. I made it a few episodes in the last season, and I just hit a point where I thought, I don't care about any of these people. I don't care what happens to them. Like the whole, I mean, they started this genre of like lots of unsympathetic characters. I didn't care anymore. And I stopped. I never made it to the mysterious ending where you don't know what happened.
So you didn't see the ending?
No, I've heard about it. I get it. And you know what? What happened to Tony Soprano? I don't care. I didn't care then. The Wire. Now, that was a show. There were people I cared about. The Wire.
The Wire was awesome.
That's way better than The Sopranos. The Wire was
great.
For me.
That's a better show. A better show, but The Sopranos was great.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.